This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Wimbledon, the Grand Dame of tennis tournaments, is temporarily distracting Brits from the confusion wrought by their collective decision to leave the European Union. Some of those embracing that distraction may have noticed that perhaps left-handed players are not faring as well as they did in the days when such sinister siders as Rod Laver and Martina Navratilova not only ruled but created the impression that being left-handed constituted a considerable advantage on the courts. Is it true? Was it ever?
Well, my dad says if I wasn't left-handed, I wouldn't have been a professional tennis player. So when your dad says that, probably something to it.
That's Tim Wilkerson. During his professional tennis career from 1977 to 1993, Wilkerson used a move favored by many left-handed players, the swinging serve. When serving from the left side of the court, Wilkerson would hit a spinning shot aimed at a right-hander's relatively weaker one-handed backhand.
And that one-handed return of serve was going to come back not that fast. And that's why a lot of guys would run up to the net and play the volley off that shot, because you're going to have a play at it.
Wilkerson, once the 23rd best male player in the world, reached the quarterfinals of the U.S. Open in 1986. Other lefty players have used the strategy he's mentioned to get considerably further.
And there it is, the classic serve volley from John McEnroe.
Lefty John McEnroe won 7 Grand Slam singles titles from 79 to 84. Rod Laver won 11 from 60 to 69. On the women's side, Martina Navratilova won 18 Grand Slam singles titles from 78 to 90.
You know, others like Manuel Arantes, you know, Roscoe Tanner, the list goes on.
That's longtime tennis writer Douglas Robson. He recently explored the history of the lefty advantage.
You know, the lefties were big winners of some of the biggest, you know, titles in the game.
The advantage was so significant that lefties dreaded playing other lefties.
Well, I hated it.
Again, Tim Wilkerson.
I hated it because all of my best shots, you know, that swinging lefty serve was right into their forehand now.
It becomes a little difficult for us.
That's lefty Diane Fromholtz-Ballastrat, who played on the women's tour from 1973 until 1990.
When you come up against a left-hander, well, then you've got to reverse your game as well. So it becomes a little bit tricky.
And forcing an opponent to reverse her game wasn't the only advantage lefties were thought to have during Fromholtz-Ballastrat's pro career. Research in the mid-80s suggested lefties had innate neurological advantages in sports due to better spatiomotor skills.
I got 2 sons who are left-handed, so I was imagining fantastic sporting careers for them.
That's John Eggleton, a professor of cognitive neuroscience at Cardiff University in Wales.
There are lots and lots of claims that left-handed people might be different, have different attributes to right-handed people, that there might be differences in the way in which their brain in some way is organized.
But in 1989, Eggleton, the hopeful father of left-handers, co-published research that went some distance toward dashing his dreams.
There's no evidence that left-handers are any better than right-handers. So there are very clear strategic reasons. There's very clear reasons why in some sports you really want a mixture of left and right-handers. But for purely sort of skilled ballistic movement, we looked at things like darts and we looked at snooker. We couldn't find any evidence that they actually have any kind of neurological or innate advantage that predisposes them to be better at sport per se.
Perhaps coincidentally, at about the same time that Eggleton published his research, the strategic advantage in tennis was starting to decline.
And I specifically remember towards the tail end of my career,
Tim Wilkerson, the former player whose father said he wouldn't have been a pro if he hadn't had the left-hander's edge.
I started off losing to Arthur Ashe and Stan Smith, and I finished up losing to Andre Agassi and Michael Chang and those guys, Jim Courier, but it was a definite difference when all of a sudden you're hitting your swinging left-handed serve into a huge two-handed backhand. So that was a dramatic difference.
The rise of the more powerful two-handed backhand has countered the advantage of that swinging lefty serve. Here's writer Douglas Robson again.
And you'll see with a lot of the best players today that their backhands are no longer liabilities or even attackable. They're great assets and weapons.
More great contending from Djokovic.
The two-handed backhand has helped propel Novak Djokovic to number one in the world. But it's not only the two-handed backhand that's been chipping away at that lefty's advantage. Douglas Robson believes that improved rackets and strings, plus more homogeneous court surfaces, have made other lefty tactics, such as the slice shot, less effective.
The overall feeling is that lefties aren't what they used to be.
But is that lefty advantage gone forever? Maybe not, at least if Diane Frumholz-Ballestrat has her way. The former pro and current coach has been watching the ongoing Wimbledon tournament, which, notably, is missing star lefty Rafael Nadal, who's out with an injury, and she thinks some of the remaining lefties just aren't using some of the moves that used to work so well.
The public, if you notice, they clap. They like to clap the little angle shots and the drop shots. They like to see that. But at the moment, they're just getting all this hard, fast hitting, and the left-handers are just doing the same thing, whereas they should be developing all these little intricate shots and finesses.
Frumholz-Ballestrat thinks that some of the problem is that lefties are being taught by coaches who don't fully grasp the player's potential because the coaches are righties.
I see other coaches come on with juniors and they're not teaching them to turn the shoulders well enough, or they're not teaching them to toss the ball out to the left on their serve. So there's little intricacies that make up good players that is not taught to the left-handers.
Maybe one day coaches will try to get lefties back into that advantageous slide and spin of things. But for the time being, Douglas Robson says lefties aren't intimidating opponents as they once did.
Most of the righties that I spoke to described left-handedness facing a left-handed opponent as mildly inconvenient or disruptive, but not a big deal.
And so our investigation of the left-hander's advantage ends not with a bang, but with, well, not with a whimper, with a shrug, I guess, or perhaps more accurately with that muffled pop, pop, pop of right-handers successfully returning the shots of left-handers and vice versa, as attributes other than handedness determine who'll move into Wimbledon's later rounds. Since the death of former Tennessee women's basketball coach Pat Summitt on Tuesday, former players, rival coaches, and even people the legendary coach just happened to meet once have been sharing their stories. But one of our favorites was shared while the coach was still alive, and it is one of our favorites because of Coach Summitt's good-hearted reaction to the story. It was January of 2012. Coach Summitt had been diagnosed with early-onset Alzheimer's disease the previous May. In a few months, she would step down from the job she held for 38 years to become head coach emeritus. Summitt was the honored guest at a luncheon for supporters of Tennessee women's basketball, and her coaching staff started telling their favorite stories about their boss. At times, it had the feel of a roast. This audio of then-associate head coach Holly Warlick comes to us courtesy of the Knoxville News Sentinel.
Y'all know how intense Pat is. I mean, just off the chain. Back when you could talk about weight, we can't tell them to lose pounds. We just got to tell them to get in shape now. But Pat told this young lady, you know, you got to lose 15 pounds. It's the bottom line. So we all, at the beginning of the year, we meet as a staff and a team, and right when they go back to school, where this young lady came in, and Pat was like, are you kidding me? She goes, get back in my office right now. So the little girl went back and got in the office, and she sat down, and she goes, what have you been doing? She goes, well, I've been... No, you've been doing nothing. You have been doing nothing. She goes, what did I tell you before you left? I told you to lose 15 pounds. You're not getting back on the court till you lose 15 pounds. The girl's like about to bust out crying. She goes, just leave. Just leave. The kid gets up, and Pat calls me in there. And she goes, I just chewed so-and-so out. And I said, really? Okay. So we went back into the meeting. All right, and so we get in the meeting, and we go around and tell each other, I'm Abby Conklin, I'm a senior, and this young lady goes, and she says, hi, I'm Beth Bartel, and I'm a manager, I think.
I had a senior moment.
I had a senior moment. Alzheimer's disease is dreadful and dreaded. It is no less than the loss of self. Pat Summitt's punchline to her colleague's story, I had a senior moment, spits in the eye of the cruel affliction with which she had been diagnosed. Summitt's career and her life were cut short by Alzheimer's, but for as long as she could do it, she continued to support and encourage the women playing basketball at Tennessee. It was, she said, her passion. That passion and the energy with which Pat Summitt pursued it built the game to which she devoted herself. Her most successful rival, UConn women's coach Gino Auriemma, said this week of Summit, "Lots of people coach the game, but very few people get to define the game." But Pat Summit didn't just define women's college basketball. She grabbed it by the ears and hauled it into prominence. She was so successful that at one point she was asked whether she'd like to coach the men's team at Tennessee. Her perspective was such that she asked whether that was supposed to constitute a step up. It would be silly to say that if it hadn't been for Pat Summit, women's basketball wouldn't have achieved the popularity it has achieved. Lots and lots of talented athletes and ambitious coaches would have made sure that happened if Pat Summit had decided to become something other than a coach, a fiery preacher, perhaps. But it would be sillier not to credit Summit with energizing the entire sport. That she and her family had to endure the terrible and terrifying circumstances associated with Alzheimer's disease is beyond sad. That she managed a positive attitude and sense of humor through her decline is inspiring. That's an adjective perhaps too often applied to athletes and coaches, but in Pat Summit's case, it's a perfect fit. There's more Only a Game to come, but when you get a chance, please leave your comments about the program on iTunes and rate us. That way, all podcasters everywhere will know we're available. I'm Bill Littlefield. Former Heisman Trophy winner Johnny Manziel, a.k.a. Johnny Football, has been suspended by the NFL for substance abuse. That's where we're going to begin our conversation this week on Three Stories You Should Know. My guests are Nancy Armour of USA Today and Will Leach of Sports on Earth, who joins us via Skype. Welcome back to both of you.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Will.
Hello.
Nancy, you're going to go first this time.
My story is, as you mentioned, Johnny Manziel. He was suspended this week by the NFL for 4 games, which realistically, it probably is the effective end of his career because he's also facing a suspension, could be as much as 6 games, for the assault, alleged assault on his ex-girlfriend earlier this year. With his history, his volatility, I don't think anybody's going to take a chance on him, at least not until he's proven that he's gotten himself together. Which brings us to the larger issue, and the sadder issue is that this guy's spiraling down the drain. His father has said that he wants him to go to jail because he wants his kid to stay alive, and you know, he's just on one endless party, and it's really, really, really sad to see somebody throw his life away. I really don't care about his NFL career. It's more that, you know, here's a kid who's got so much potential, and he's just trashing it.
Yeah, Nancy, I read your piece about this, and it was terrific, and it brought up a really great point.
Thank you.
Anyone that has dealt with addiction in their family or with one of their friends, one of the things that Manziel did is he had like this one last party in Cabo. He said gave himself like a July 1st deadline to like pull it together. And anyone who's ever dealt with addiction knows that is just simply not how it works. And I think this is a kid. I mean, he's 23, 24. He's still so young to be going down this road and still not understand the ramifications of what's going on outside of the football idea. It's a little terrifying.
It's interesting to me, Will, that you bring up his age because I think it's harder for young people sometimes to find recovery than it is for old people who say, okay, I've had it, I'm done, I'm going to get straight. 23-year-old is looking around and saying, gee, all the other 23-year-olds are doing this stuff. How can I not do it? It seems to me that addicts find recovery in all sorts of different ways. Some of them use organizations like AA or NA, and others find another way. But the most important ingredient, perhaps, to anybody's recovery is a supportive community. And you don't find a supportive community when you announce you're going to have one more big party in Cabo.
The thing that is, you know, makes this even more troubling is he's got resources. You know, he's got parents who are supportive, who love him. He's got, you know, people in the NFL are still reaching out to him. Troy Vincent said earlier this week that he's still trying to get a hold of them. And the NFL has said, doesn't matter if you're under contract or not, they'll help him get help. But until the person themselves says, yes, I do want to get help and really means it, you know, this is just an endless spiral and it's not going anywhere well.
Will, the Cavaliers championship parade is long over. Probably they can still hear the echoes in Cleveland, although I'm not sure. But anyway, LeBron James has already left Cleveland. He's on vacation in Spain. But I understand that you still want to talk about basketball. What's going on?
First off, the party may be over, but I still think J.R. Smith has not put a shirt on yet. I think he's still out there having fun.
Do we have the video on that?
he did not listen to the president and still has not put his shirt back on. So I want to talk about the USA basketball. Of course, the Olympics are coming up. For years, of course, the Olympics were amateurs. And then the U.S. started to lose. And then the Olympics allowed professionals to be in. So we had the dream team and we dominated because America's on top. Yay, USA, USA, USA. Then, as we saw, players started to realize, it's a little bit of a pain, and I want to relax, I want to enjoy myself. So they stopped going to the Olympics, trickling out, and then we started to lose. So then the cycle came back to the other side. Time to make America great again in basketball. And so we had LeBron James and Kobe Bryant and Carmelo Anthony playing together. Yay, America dominates again. This is awesome. And now we're seeing that start to stop again. Steph Curry's not playing. LeBron James isn't playing. There's a lot of players that aren't coming. The U.S. is still the favorites, but this is the way the cycle works. The irony of this, of course, the rest of the world is catching up with this. We all have this idea that when we really care, we're going to bring in all of our great USA players and we're going to dominate. But eventually, we're going to play all of our best players and we're still going to lose.
I take the opposite tact. I mean, yes, everybody wanted to see the biggest of the big names, LeBron, Steph, Dwayne Wade, those guys, they wanted to see them play. But if you look at this roster, you still have Jimmy Butler. You still have Kyrie Irving. You still have Draymond Green. You still have, you know, DeAndre Jordan, Harrison Barnes. This is not a bunch of scrubs. It's not even a bunch of, you know, college players, no offense to them. And yes, I do agree that the rest of the world is catching up, but they don't have the depth that the U.S. has. So yeah, maybe the games will be a little bit closer, but I don't think the sky is falling, and I don't think we're going to see anybody standing on top of the medals podium except for those guys wearing USA across their chest.
You know, my first observation here is I'm wondering why Draymond Green is allowed to play in the Olympics at all after the way he misbehaved during the entire NBA postseason. Are they going to wear extra cups, all the people that play against the U.S.? I mean, this guy is a menace on the court.
Maybe that's part of the game plan.
Well, great, great game plan. I love it. I'm going to speak from personal experience here. I did see some basketball at the London Olympics. I saw LeBron et al. Play against Australia, and it was pretty dull. I also saw Argentina play against Brazil, and it was terrific. And both Argentina and Brazil had NBA players, of course. The quality of play was very high. But the point was, nobody knew who was going to win that game.
I have to say, all my points that I have completely gone out of my head now that I've just become obsessed with the fact of Draymond Green causing an international incident. I'm legitimately concerned. So, yeah, I don't care whether we win or lose. Let's just get out of there without him causing any major problems.
I think this is the first time in the not very long history of Three Stories You Should Know that I'm going to go into the area of tennis. I've been watching this guy, Marcus Willis, ranked number 772 in the world of pro tennis. He had to win 6 matches to get into the main draw at Wimbledon. Then he won another match, which earned him the right to get destroyed by Roger Federer. And instead, he took 7 games off Federer. He didn't get destroyed. Everybody in the stands had a great time. His mum was interviewed, and she said he's very untidy and never washes up, but it's good that he's got some clean socks on. This was great. This was more fun than anybody should have at a sporting event, as far as I'm concerned. What do you think?
I have to say, my favorite part of this match is that he dressed up like Federer. That is, without question, the best part. He wore a Federer.
That is the best part.
Branded. Yeah, he wore a Federer-branded shirt. He wore the headband. You know, there's something kind of great. But realize, not only is he 772nd in the world, he recently lost like 50 pounds. Like, he's really, like, there's really this kind of like amazing story. There's pictures of him playing tennis looking like an entirely different person altogether from like a year ago. It really is one of those. This is the type of story. I know we say this a lot, but like, if this were a movie, it would be like, this is a stupid movie.
There are two things that for me tie for the best part of this story. One is the fact that he dressed like Federer. Two is that he still lives at home with his parents, which is
that's how they know that
he's
a slob.
He's so messy. Yes, exactly. This is fantastic. I mean, this is a guy playing Wimbledon, and he's still living in his parents' basement. You know, even Federer's like, yeah, this is a great story. I love seeing this.
Well, of course, he didn't have to sweat too much in that particular match. He can save his strength for playing somebody who's ranked a little higher than 772 somewhere later on in the tournament. My guests for Three Stories You Should Know have been Nancy Armour of USA Today and Will Leach of Sports on Earth. Thank you, both of you.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Will.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, here's a story. Maybe it's apocryphal, maybe it's not. There's really no way to verify it, but it goes like this. It's 1973, and a Mississippi high school basketball all-star game has just ended. But the officials have a problem. Player A has 21 points. Player B has 21 points. Player A has 14 rebounds. Player B has 14 rebounds. The officials don't know who deserves the MVP trophy. So Player A says to Player B, "You take the trophy. I've got my sights set on the NBA." The man who claims to be Player A is Billy Ray Bates, and he did eventually make it to the NBA. After being drafted by the Houston Rockets in 1978, he bounced around in the CBA for a couple of years before finally debuting with an NBA team, and he was spectacular for a while. But off-the-court problems kept him from ever living up to his promise. Billy Ray Bates tells us that story in his own words.
I'm 60 years old now. Time just flew by. And before you know it, it's all over and done. It's hard for me to look back on my career now because it's so painful. I had it all in the palm of my hand, and I let it slip away. I'm a native of Mississippi. I went to college in Kentucky and got lucky and got drafted to the Houston Rockets. That's basically who Billy Ray Bates is. I love basketball. I love going to church. I think I was dunking in the seventh grade. I was basically the shortest guy around, and all of a sudden I shot up like Kobe. I had the ability to just jump around like a deer. I was really Michael Jordan before Michael Jordan. I played basketball for like 35 years. I played more than Michael Jordan. I played more than Kobe. I played more than all of them. I played in Switzerland, Uruguay, France, Italy, Philippine basketball, PBA, NBA, CBA. I done played everywhere. Got picked up by the Portland Trailblazers. And that was my big debut. I got off the plane. It was so many cameras in my eyes. I panicked. I was like, wow, what are you guys doing here? Oh, we need to interview you, Mr. Bates. Oh, my God. It took me an hour to get out of the airport. It was a lot to Gasper. You know what I mean? You could have anything you want. I had to pay for nothing to go in a restaurant. Oh, Billy, no, you ain't got to pay. You okay? I was like, wow, I got the key to the city. You know what I mean? I could have played there 10 years and been successful. But at the rate I was going and the people that I let into my life just shot the fame right out from under me. Some bad things started to happen off the court. It just seemed like the wrong people was coming into my life and they was trying to lead me down the wrong path. And some of them did. Things got out of hand. I wish I would have never had that drink, that first one. That first one was the wrong choice. I think I had my share of being a sociable drinker, and it did affect my career. I think people overreacted. And then if you see a guy sitting at the restaurant, you know what I mean, and he's sitting there with some drinks, you got some friends sitting there, it doesn't mean he's an alcoholic. It just means that he's having a good time. You know, he's being sociable. You know what I mean? When you say 12 o'clock, I get scared of that. I was cut from the Houston Rockets at 12 o'clock. I cut from the 76ers at 12 o'clock. I was cut from the Blazers at 12 o'clock. I'm like, man, what's going on here? It was rough, but after I got cut, released from the Portland Trailblazers, my agent, Steve Kaufman, called me and he said, I got you another contract in the Philippines. And he said, this is a good place for you to be. I said, well, as long as money's coming in, I go play anywhere. I went over there, I averaged like 50 points a game, became a national hero. Oh, my first game, I scored 64 points. and turned the gym completely out. Well, it was this one writer. He was a good friend of all the players. After the game, we used to go back to the quarters. That's where all the players live. So we all go back there and we sit down at the table and they bring us all kind of food out and everything. And then he looked at me and he said, he said, Black Superman. I said, who? He said, that's going to be your name. Anybody, you go over to the Philippines and ask him, do you know this guy named Billy Ray Bates? They call him the Black Superman. And they'll tell you, yeah, we know him. He's the best basketball player we ever seen. Yeah, that's how I got my name. I made a big mistake back in 1998. I was up under the influence. I wasn't under the influence of drugs. I was under the influence of alcohol. I had two jobs. I had a car. We had just moved to the new condominium. It was on a Sunday. I said, I'm going to play the lottery. The lottery machine is down. So I go across the street. It was down. I said, well, you know what? It's a nice sunny day. It's 80 degrees. Maybe I walk down the road to my friend's house. That was the devil telling me, come on, you just don't see what's going to happen to you. So instead of me going back home right then, I made the wrong choice. I bought a drink. I let somebody put an idea in my head.
You were trying to rob the place, right? The store?
I let some young people talk me into doing that. And what I realized is when I got out there in the middle, they were nowhere around. And by me and that devil that I was drinking got me in trouble. And I apologize to the business and I apologize to the kid that was there. I didn't kill anybody. A guy got a nick on his ear and I got 7 years. So I just try to keep it moving and hope that nobody brings that up anymore. I hope nobody brings that up anymore. You know what I mean? Oh, my God. You're branded because it was criminal. And that's one of the reasons why I can't get the job I want today. And I know now that if I would have turned around and went back home that day, my life would have been different. I would have landed a great job in the NBA. I would have had a great coaching job somewhere, you know what I mean? I could have been that great guy. But I always get labeled as a bad guy. But my wife still loves me. My daughter still loves me. My grandson loves me to death. My daughter told me, she said, you know what you need to do? I said, yeah, give me some ideas. She said, you need to just turn into a nerd. You know, you just sit home, you don't do nothing. You know what I mean? You're a couch potato. And that's what I do here. I'm waiting just like everybody else to see how the story gonna play out. But trust me, there won't be no more trouble. Especially with the law. When I see the police, I turn around and go the other way. Choo! I go, Black Superman. He's out of there.
That's former NBA player Billy Ray Bates. Our story was produced by Karen Given and mixed by George Hicks in collaboration with Sports Illustrated, who profiled Billy Ray Bates in the 2016 Where Are They Now issue, available now. We'll be bringing you more stories from Sports Illustrated's Where Are They Now special issue in the next few weeks, but you can hear them first at si.com/WATN. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Next week on the show, Charlie Pierce. Hey, I sense a pattern here. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Maury Wills willed his way into the 1962 All-Star Game, and it wasn't easy. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
I saw what you did there, Bill.
Yeah.
Willed his way into the league?
It wasn't easy.
Very nice. Hey, Bill, we got new friends.
Yeah?
Hello, and this is very special to me, my home away from home. Hi to all our new listeners in Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yeah, Marquette.
Not only that, but Baraboo, Prairie du Chien, Oconomowoc. Also, the towns of Luck, Independence, and Liberty.
Excellent. We're going to begin our talk today with some losers. I give you England, bounced from the Euro Cup on Monday.
I don't want it. You want it back?
I know. Nobody does at this point. If they're out of the European Union, they don't want them either. Anyway, perennial powerhouse Iceland bounced them right out of the tournament. Iceland!
I'm sorry. I don't care if Iceland beats the United States at this point. I love those guys. Iceland can come over and play in the Copa Americas for all I care.
Have you a favorite among the tabloid headlines inspired by England's unlikely loss to Iceland in those European championships?
Actually, it's not a tabloid. It's from the Times of London, and the headline is, "Take your language with you," British told. Zootalore!
Shortly after Iceland's win, a video went viral of Iceland announcer Gumi Ben announcing that winning goal, and we're going to listen to it. I'm pretty sure.
Once NORAD came off alert, everything was fine.
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure my dog understood that.
I fully admit I do not speak Icelandic, but I don't think those were words.
And yet, it was unmistakable what he was trying to say. We talked a few weeks ago about San Francisco Giants pitcher Madison Bumgarner's desire to take part in the home run derby at the All-Star Game this year, and apparently that's not going to happen. Why not?
Well, the players' union, according to Bruce Bochy, says they don't want a pitcher taking another player's spot. Once again, you know, it seems like people who organize and run professional sports at the top level have some sort of quirk about not letting people have as much fun as possible.
Yeah, this is sort of an NFL-ish thing to do.
It's a very NFL. Yeah. It's a very Goodellian move on the part of the players' union.
Charlie, we have not spoken since Pat Summitt died on Tuesday. She was diagnosed back in 2011 with early-onset Alzheimer's disease. No Division I basketball coach has presided over more wins than her total of 1,098 of them, and Tennessee women won 8 national championships under her guidance. Your thoughts on her career and her impact?
She's a genuine pioneer, and as I think we said in other contexts, this has been a really bad year for icons. Mm. She changed the face of women's basketball and through that the face of women's sports in this country. She is no worse than one of the 3 best basketball coaches of any kind who ever lived in this country. I mean, that's not arguable anymore.
That's quite a distinction as well. Let's talk a little bit about upsets. Leicester City, as Premier League champions, was an enormous upset earlier this year. Does Marcus Willis's accomplishment at Wimbledon compete with that?
Well, I mean, they're already pitching a movie about the guy.
Of course they are.
I mean, he won 6 victories in qualifying, and then by the way, he's the world's number 776th ranked player. I didn't think the rankings went down that low. How do you distinguish between the world's number 772nd and 773rd ranked player?
Tie break.
I mean, did one guy break a shoelace or something during a changeover, so he drops one spot to 773? Anyway, Marcus has been rampaging through Wimbledon. He beat number 54, Ricardis Barrancas, and I wouldn't know Ricardis Barrancas if he sat in my lap. But already there's a movie guy interested in his story because Marcus Willis's other job is teaching tennis to 5-year-olds.
Yeah, that's right.
Somewhere Bud Collins is smiling at this.
The fiscal year has ended, and it was a bad one for NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. He lost over $2 million in salary. I just don't know how he's going to take that kind of hit.
Well, he's got $32 million other ways to keep himself from utter despair. Yeah, he made $32 million in the fiscal year 2015, in which he was sort of a fool. So this is another proof that America is a great country.
The China American Football League. I'm sorry, I can't quite say that without
laughing
a little bit.
Well, man, this is great. Are you kidding?
They held their inaugural draft last month, and play will begin in October. So are we excited about American football in China?
Well, I honest to God have to pick a team. And I'm not going to go with the Beijing Lions because that's like, you know, stepping in and becoming a Dallas Cowboys fan. You got to go out and find yourself an underdog. I thought very seriously about the Qingdao Clipper, because I like singular nicknames like Crimson Tide and Green Wave. But then I saw the logo for the Shenzhen Naja, and they have a cobra.
Cobra.
I think that's my ball club.
Okay.
Yes. I think I think I'll be following them and probably going to Las Vegas and betting on them.
All right. Here's a headline for you. Yamir Yager gives sandwich to photographer camped outside his house. I wonder if that's some kind of Czech hospitality thing.
Way to go, Yaramir. It's a good-looking sandwich, too. I mean, he they made a sandwich. It looks like a ham and cheese.
Yeah.
And Yaramir put in a banana and a Twix bar.
Sure.
To go. It's like, I wonder if he put in a brown paper bag. You know, next time I'm down there, if I'm stuck for lunch, I'm just going to go sit out in front of Yaramir Yager's house with a camera.
There you
exactly.
Go. Perfect. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well, of course. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill. Hi, Wisconsin!
Bill Mallon is an Olympic historian, but he's not just your average humdrum sort of Olympic historian.
There's a subgroup of people, and we call ourselves the Oly Madmen, O-L-Y, Madmen. And we actually named ourselves before the TV show, but it relates to our sort of insane interest in this hobby.
Mallon is also a former pro golfer, and he recently retired from a career as an elbow and shoulder surgeon. But since his days in medical school, when he says he found himself with a little spare time, Mallon's hobby has been collecting every stat, every bio, every story from every Olympian. And like other sports-related avocations, it's a pretty competitive field.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We love it when we come up with something new. I came up with something about a tennis player from 1924 that nobody knew anything about earlier this year. I loved it when I found it.
Well, tell me what you found.
Well, it was a guy that was a tennis player from Ireland who was always listed as Edwin McCrae, M-C-C-R-E-A. And we couldn't find anything about him. We had no data on him at all. And then for some reason, I went to a tennis forum, and it listed him as Edwin Darcy McCrae. It gave his middle name. So then I just Googled Darcy McCrae. It turned out he was a urologist in Ireland, then moved to England. Then tragically, in 1944, he and his wife were hosting a dinner party, and a bomb from the Battle of Britain hit their house, killing them and everyone at the dinner party. I mean, it's an unbelievable story.
Not all the stories Mallon collects end quite so dramatically. Mallon and his fellow Oly Madmen are in the process of signing a contract to become the official stats provider for the International Olympic Committee, and they've created a database, an electronic searchable record that holds every tidbit of information they've obsessively collected over the years.
And in that database, we have a list of Olympic family relations. Whenever one Olympian's related to another, we put it into the database. And at current, I think there's about 7,000 relations in the database.
Wow. I guess that's not incredible, because genetics has a lot to do with how successful you are as an athlete.
Yeah, exactly. There's about 127,000 Olympic athletes to date. So let's see, probably about 6% of them are related in some way. It turned out there's 200 sets of twins. Incredibly enough, it's an even 200 right now. Something like 185 of them have always competed in the same sport. Hmm. So I bet it relates to the soccer moms that they only have to take the kids to one practice instead of two different sports.
But this year, one family from Estonia has raised the stakes. Twins, you say? Ha! How about triplets? How did you find out about the Estonian triplets, Leila, Lena, and Lily Luik?
That one was easy. That's been all over the news.
They call themselves the Trio to Rio, and all three are marathoners. Mallon says none of the sisters has come close to world-class times, so we shouldn't expect any of them to be medal contenders. But as soon as the Trio to Rio qualified for Rio, people like me have been calling up Bill Mallon and asking if the Luik sisters really are the first triplets to compete in the Olympics. The answer is yes, but how can we be sure?
The Oly Madmen have connections to a lot of Olympic historians from various countries. We'd have heard about it if there'd been triplets. Plus, I ran a query on our database. I'm pretty good with computers, and I ran a query looking for three people with the same last name and same date of birth. And I came up with a few people, but I could quickly prove they weren't triplets.
given the competitive nature of the Olympics, should we expect to see quadruplets from somewhere qualifying?
That'll be hard. First of all, in something like track and field or in swimming, you know, there's a limit to how many people can compete from the same country. The limit is 2 per event in swimming and 3 per event for track and field. So you can't have quadruplets in either one of those. You could have it in a team sport. Field hockey might be the best chance for this to happen because there are 11 players.
Are you listening, moms of quadruplets? Field hockey is the sport, and the race is on for Tokyo 2020. The Brooklyn Dodgers brought Jackie Robinson into the major leagues in 1947, and that changed everything for black ball players, right? When Robinson retired, Maury Wills, also under contract to the Dodgers, was finishing the 5th of his 8 seasons in the organization's minor league system. In 1959, Wills finally got the opportunity to demonstrate his specialty, stealing bases in the bigs. 3 years later, he stole 104 of them, and he made the National League All-Star team.
Good afternoon, baseball fans. This is Joe Garagiola welcoming you to the District of Columbia Stadium in the first All-Star baseball game of 1962.
Since he had grown up in Washington, D.C., he was especially pleased that the game would be held there. Will spent time with family and friends before heading to the ballpark alone rather than with the other players. Michael Leahy, who has written often about Maury Wills, recalls the consequence of that decision.
When he arrived at the players' entrance, he encountered a security guard, gave his name, Maury Wills, the Los Angeles Dodgers, a member of the National League All-Star Squad. The guard didn't believe him, didn't believe he was Maury Wills, despite the fact that Maury was carrying his Los Angeles Dodgers blue-colored equipment bag, and refused him entry. He can still see the security guard, still hear his voice and his words, can hear the tone of his voice.
Wills told Leahy it went like this.
Get out of here. I'm not going to say it again. You don't belong here, boy.
But I'm a player.
I told you to move, boy.
A panicked Maury at some point during that conversation saw the then Cincinnati Reds great outfielder Frank Robinson and called out to him in an effort to get Frank to say to the security guard, yes, I know him. That's indeed a player on our team. And Maury called out, the security guard wheeled to Robinson and said, do you know this guy? And Frank responded, never seen this guy in my life.
After a Hall of Fame career, Frank Robinson would go on to become MLB's first black manager. His sense of humor may seem twisted, but certainly he knew what his all-star teammate had been through. Anyway, Wills eventually made it past the security guard with the help of a National League official. When he took the field in the pregame introduction, his reputation as a base stealer preceded him.
Maury Wills, boy with the flying feet, Maury Wills of the Los Angeles Dodgers.
And you had Maury Wills on that day, who had been rebuffed by the security guard, allowed into the ballpark, and then went on to have this majestic game, was the game's most valuable player in a 3-1 National League victory, stole bases and ran the American League ragged, was the MVP, and there's newsreel footage of President Kennedy applauding as Maury Wills is doing all this. Maury said it was wonderful that day to walk out of the stadium with a trophy, to be the most valuable player of the game, the best player on the planet Earth on that day. And on Maury's way out, as the team exited, Maury made sure that the security guard had a look at that nice trophy that he carried as he left the ballpark. But still, he couldn't get out of his mind that conversation with the security guard. It haunts him to this day.
Wills had been with the Dodgers for 3.5 years. He was 29 years old, but at 5'11", 170 pounds, he was not a physically imposing fellow. Do we know that the confrontation with the security guard was purely a racial incident?
Maury believed it was, and, you know, it was an odd intersection that day. I mean, we're talking 1962, a year when Maury would become the National League's most valuable player, would break Ty Cobb's single-season stolen base record. And so you had this giant of the game there for the All-Star game, a man who was going to be the first African-American to break a revered record of a white legend. And yet one could be on the cover, say, of Sports Illustrated magazine one week in 1962 if he were black, and the next week be denied service at some restaurant or hotel in the United States.
To some, the summer of the 1962 All-Star Game probably seems distant. Not to me. I was a year short of high school. I remember watching Maury Wills run, and I remember that before Henry Aaron broke Babe Ruth's career home run record 12 years later, Aaron received death threats from people who didn't want to see that distinction in the hands of a black man. Professional baseball has changed in lots of ways since then. Great black athletes today seem more likely to choose careers in basketball or football than in baseball, and major league teams are inclined to look for talent in the Latin American countries where that talent is less expensive to develop. But when we consider what's happened and what is happening today to minority citizens who lack the celebrity of pro athletes, does what happened to Maury Wills before the 1962 All-Star Game seem all that distant? Michael Leahy included Maury Wills in his new book, The Last Innocents, subtitled The Collision of the Turbulent 60s and the Los Angeles Dodgers. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our intern is Ian Foster, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Maury Wills.
One of the first things I was taught was the Ten Commandments. Of these, the most profound, to me anyway, was, "Thou shalt not steal."
Wow, he was quick to get to rap, too, back in 1963. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game, and thank you for listening.